After I got the job, of course, none of them are political. They don't really, you know, they're antitrust lawyers. Several of them said to me, well, I'm sure your husband's a good friend of President Clinton's. I'm sure. I'd say, well, he's friendly with President Clinton. He's known him a long time, but he had nothing to do with me getting this job. And they'd say, really? I assumed he got you the job. I said, that's just not. And, you know, if you think about it a minute, what president would take a call? I mean, for one thing, there are a lot of people in politics. There are governors, there are senators, there are House members, I mean, there are committee chairmen. If the president is going to appoint wives of all kinds of male politicians, he's going to have a lot of wives in the administration. And secondly, what president would consider that a good thing to do for an important job? I mean, nobody would. But people who are not political, I can understand it. You know, these guys are antitrust lawyers. It just sort of like, that has to be what happened. But anyway, that was sort of my history in Washington. When I first got there, it was like going to the moon. But after 10 or 11 years, you know, you make your way and meet people, and it was very congenial. There are a lot of nice people in Washington. You know, it was funny. One thing I came to understand, people in Washington don't understand how many smart people there are in New Mexico. And people in New Mexico often don't understand how many smart people are in Washington. Yeah. It's sort of odd. And I understand it, really, because they really don't have much to do with each other. So everybody's operating on stereotypes, you know. Mm-hmm. And today, especially, stereotypes of Washington are overwhelmingly negative, but they've probably been negative a long time. People tend to think, these bureaucrats in Washington, they're just... And people in Washington, they tend to look at what Jeff said, people in the East used to call the big square states out West. You know, they're just sort of unknown to them, you know. They don't have a good, and how would they? I cannot tell you the difference between Vermont and New Hampshire, so why would they know? We're a big country, and, you know, I guess you naturally operate on stereotypes, but anyway, that's my little history in Washington.
Well, you were the first woman to head the antitrust division. Well, let's talk about your experience in antitrust cases before you went to the antitrust division of the Justice Department.
I started an antitrust in 1977 when the Bigby firm in Santa Fe associated me to do the antitrust part of a billion-dollar case, I think the biggest in New Mexico history, United Nuclear versus General Atomic. It went to trial about 3.5 months after I joined the team. I filed cartel interrogatories and eventually motions to compel answers, motion to find facts provable from documents that weren't produced that were in Canada, and ultimately a default judgment motion for discovery failures, which was granted by Judge Felter, upheld by the New Mexico Supreme Court and cert denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. But that did not end the case. The case went on with an arbitration that General Atomic filed against United Nuclear and a later lawsuit by United Nuclear against General Atomic that was settled for $300 million that I wasn't involved in these latter phases. All I did was the antitrust discovery and default discovery motions and default judgment in the first phase of the case. After that, I represented three other companies against General Atomic as lead antitrust counsel. I represented Supron Gas in a defense case as lead antitrust counsel. I represented the state of Florida in a consumer class in a billion-dollar case against Southern Bell in the late 80s and 90s. So when I went to the Justice Department, and, you know, you need to have experience to get one of these jobs. For 16 years, I had been doing major antitrust litigation as lead counsel, and I had done a lot of other, these were all billion-dollar cases, and I had done a lot of other smaller antitrust cases as well. That's what I had been doing for 16 years at the time I was appointed by President Clinton in 1993.
Okay. So, was there any pressure on you to, or did anyone say, don't go after these people, or why don't you leave them alone or something?
Never, 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 never. The Clinton administration was so totally pure. They don't get the credit they should for that, honestly. We did the Archer Daniel Midland's case, and the head of the company went to jail for 5 years for price fixing. His father, named Duane Andreas, was one of the most famous political people in history. He, Bob Dole, Hubert Humphrey, all these people were close friends of Duane Andreas. We never heard a word from the Clinton administration, not a word. And they don't get the credit they should for that, I don't think. I really don't. There was one person in the Justice Department, the Associate Attorney General, who was authorized to speak to the White House about cases. They never talked to me. I never heard a word.
That's good to know. Then after that, you got involved in telecommunications, right?
Yes. The 96 Telecom Act came up out of nowhere, as far as I was concerned, about 6 months. It was in January of 94. And this was an effort. The reason I was so heavily involved, and the antitrust division, but I, as head of it, testified a number of times, and we were the lead agency, and that was because the antitrust division had broken up the Bell companies from AT&T, which was long distance from the local operating company, in the consent decree that went into effect in January 1 of 84. And the Telecom Act would replace the antitrust division consent decree that was administered by Judge Green. We had 50 lawyers in the antitrust division who worked on telecom, extremely smart, expert people, and a large number of economists as well. And that was why the antitrust division was so central to the testimony, to the form of the bill. I had an incredible experience. Vice President Gore was absolutely passionate about telecom. He had been on the Commerce Committee in both the House and the Senate the whole time he was in Congress, and of course he had just become vice president in 93, so in 94 and 5 this was all recent for him. He had a meeting every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 in his office for about five of us, and I was incredibly privileged to go to, as head of the antitrust division, and it was over the Telecom Act and what was going on. You know, I used to say later, I wish those meetings could have been on C-SPAN. Not one word of politics was ever mentioned. The whole thing was policy. His chief of staff, very detailed issues of policy. What issues, what conditions should there be for Bell Company entry into long distance? It was amazing that the vice president was at that level, but that's how passionate he was about it. He wanted this to be done right on a substantive level, not politically, but that the telecommunications industry would work right. So I testified, and at one point, after the Congress, of course, went Republican in November of 94, both House and Senate, the world turned upside down as far as telecom. A bill came out of Senate Commerce in 95 that was much, much worse than the bills that were in 94. Unfortunately, the 94 bill was introduced too late to get through a Congress in 1 year. There was no way. It was a Brooks-Dingell bill. It started in the House. Anyway, the 95 bill from the Senate Commerce Committee under Larry Pressler, a Republican, Fritz Holling was ranking member, was much worse. And in our next Tuesday meeting, we briefed the vice president. I gave him the three things the division considered wrong with it. He said, boy, this is really crucial. I'm going to see the president tomorrow. I'm going to tell him this. And the darndest thing happened. He had a weekly lunch with President Clinton on Wednesdays. So that was great. I mean, you know, I'm certainly nobody to call the vice president asking what happened. I just figured I'd hear her and, you know, from his chief of staff and, you know, would see where things stood. About Wednesday afternoon, I start getting calls and faxes from all these people around town. President Clinton had gone down to the Publishers Association meeting in Dallas that Wednesday afternoon, or maybe it was Thursday, maybe it was 2 days later. He had given a speech and then had a press conference. And somebody in the audience asked him whether he had a position, or the administration did, on the bill that had come out of Senate Commerce, Senator Pressler's bill. President Clinton is so smart, he said, as a matter of fact, we do. Vice President Gore briefed me on that on Wednesday, and here are our three problems with that bill. And he ticked off the three things that I had told Gore. I'm telling you, everybody thought that I had told President Clinton, which is, of course, ridiculous. People were like, wow, this is unbelievable. We got the president on record with our 3 points. But anyway, a pitched battle followed. Later in the fall, Senator Hollings told me unless he had a letter from President Clinton outlining his objections to the Pressler bill, he didn't have any leverage to get these changes. So I immediately went to the vice president's chief of staff. We called Vice President Gore. He said, absolutely, write the letter. We sat there, pounded it out. Clinton signed it, I should say President Clinton, the next day, got it up to Senator Hollings, and the whole bill changed. But, you know, I'm not giving myself any credit here. I mean, all I was a conduit. If Vice President Gore had not been so incredibly close to it and interested in it, and had the great relationship he did with President Clinton, and if President Clinton hadn't been committed to having a competitive telecom industry, none of that would have happened. It was these people who did it, but it was a complete blast, frankly. I mean, geez, I just had a wonderful time. When I got out of the division, in the summer of 96, I announced it was basically a 4-year term. I mean, so I started looking around. I did not want to do legal work for a bell company. And if you start looking at law firms in the United States, probably 95% of them represent bell companies in one way or another. I just figured, you know, I've always wanted to go into business. I'll see if I can make a go of that. So I started looking at business instead. I talked to a couple of law firms, but I don't know. I'd been practicing law 28 years, and I also didn't want to lobby the antitrust division. You get one of these big law firms, you're representing the defendants. You're representing people a division is suing, you know, and I don't know. I just, for all kinds of reasons, I just figured I've had a great time. It's been a great, fabulous thing, and time to try something else. So I was very lucky. I had gotten to know on an airplane, oddly enough, the shuttle from New York to D.C. I sat next to a guy who was head of the fourth largest long-distance company who knew who I was, and I vaguely knew who he was. But anyway, he called me, and one thing led to another, and he offered me a business job, not a legal job, which is important in business. If you go in as general counsel or you know, some legal job, it's a sideline in businesses. So I was hired by what was called LCI International. It was small compared to the big three, but it was the fourth largest long-distance company, as head of the business of local business competing against bell companies under the new Telecom Act. So that's what I did for about a year and a half. Oddly, Qwest bought us. In March of 97, I only worked there from January of 96 to July 1st of 97. Qwest offered me a job, but I don't know. I'd had such a great time at LCI. Joe Nacho was head of it. I didn't know much about Nacho, but headquarters were in Denver. I didn't want to be commuting to Denver and sort of in a satellite office, and it just didn't seem good. So I didn't take the job, and went on, and I got this idea to try to form a local phone company, and one thing led to another and was able to do that. So I ended up in telecom. It was phenomenal. I had a wonderful time. It was just absolutely great.
I remember talking to you around that time, and you were traveling a lot. It seemed as though...
Well, I was on a plane every week. I got a lot of frequent flyer miles. It comes in handy, actually, having all those miles. No, I mean, you can't. I think most people in business travel a lot. I guess if you're in a local business, maybe you don't, but I never was. I was always in... I don't know. I was always on airplanes. I didn't mind. I got used to it. You get used to anything, frankly.
Well, that sort of brings us to what your plans are now that Jeff is retiring from the Senate.
Truthfully, I don't have any other plans other than to come back to our home in Santa Fe. We'll be back here in January of 2013. His last day is January 3rd when they swear in his replacement. And... we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't have any fixed plans. I mean, I've been having a good time. I've started taking Spanish recently. I'm really enjoying it. Jeff speaks very good Spanish, and I've just never... we love Mexico. We love Central America and South America. I don't know that we'll travel a whole lot, but it's fun to be able to speak to people, so I'm enjoying that. Anyway, I don't have any fixed plans. I really don't. Okay. I mean, it's sort of like going to Washington. I haven't really lived here in 30 years. I've got to get my feet on the ground to know the modern New Mexico.
One time when we were trying to get together to do this talk, Jeff was in China. I know you said that he isn't planning to lobby the Senate when he is out of it or anything, but is he planning to do some international sort of things?
He goes to China. He used to go to Japan almost every year when Japan was the big competitor. China, you know, subsidizes their solar and wind power industries very heavily, and it's a big problem here. And he does. He and his staff, he's chairman of the Energy Committee, of course, keep track of what's going on over there. And, you know, it's a sad thing. Both China and Germany have much bigger solar industries than we do, and they subsidize them. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., people consider that government interference with business, and yet we're getting killed because these huge countries with gigantic industries are doing what we refuse to do. And I don't know, but it's not my end of the world. I don't know much about it. I'm off the reservation here. But in any way, that's why it's important that he know what's going on in detail, not just sort of, you know, a 10-paragraph story in a newspaper. So he tries to get over. He does get over there with his staff. Their trips with just him and his five or six top staff people on the Energy Committee. Mm. So, but he's. He doesn't know what he's going to do either. I mean, Senate ethics rule prohibit you from talking about salary or any kind of compensation until you're out of the Senate. And it's still 7 months, 8 months away. So anyway, we're not in any hurry. We'll just get our feet on the ground and start exploring things once we get home. People think it's odd I don't go to Jeff's office. I say, he never came to my office. Why should I go to his office? I know nothing about what he does. I couldn't contribute anything, so. Which is true.
Are you looking forward to coming back to New Mexico leaving Washington?
Oh, we're excited. Yeah, we're thrilled. We've kept our house here. We've owned it since 77, and got some money ahead in the 2001 or two, got it fixed up. We're thrilled to be coming home. We're very excited. Good. So,
could you talk a little bit about how Washington has changed since you said it was kind of overwhelming when you went in the beginning?
It was overwhelming to me when I got there because I'd lived in Santa Fe for 15 years in New Mexico and taught at the law school. I knew hundreds and hundreds of lawyers. I knew a lot of people. I was very comfortable. I loved it. I had a great time. I was home. You get back to D.C., it's a big city. You don't know people. And frankly, in the legal profession, the wife of a senator is pretty nothing. potatoes. I mean, you know, people don't take you seriously. They assume you're a politician's wife and you don't really want to work and you really want to join a law firm to have a place to meet your friends for lunch.
And how has Washington changed over the as you're leaving Washington?
It's changed drastically, actually, in a number of ways, some very obvious, some less obvious. The level of partisanship. There's a new book out, which your readers, your listeners might be interested in, called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, by Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution and American Enterprise Institute, that talks about, these are the two most preeminent students of Congress in the country, and they've been following the Congress for 35, 40 years, very respected. And the book says openly that the Republican Party has changed so drastically from the 70s when they started following and moved to the right and gotten more partisan. And you can see that in Senator Lugar being beaten in a primary in Indiana because he was willing to talk to Democrats. That's what his opponent said. He wouldn't compromise. Lugar talked to Democrats. That's wrong. And he got defeated. It's a different place on that level. And I think people generally can see that, but it's a different place on a different level, which is the number of lobbyists and special interests. When we got there, the lobbying community in Washington, I mean, I didn't lobby. I never did anything like that. I raised money for Jeff in a couple of cycles with small breakfasts and so forth, but it was several hundred people at most, you know, 300-400. I mean, I don't have a number. There's been a book written about it, actually, by one of the top people at the Washington Post, an editor named Robert Kaiser, very respected. And he wrote a book called So Damn Much Money. And he's quoting Bob Strauss, who he asked him why he lobbied. Strauss looked at him. Strauss just said, "Is there so damn much money in it?" And there, Washington now, the lobbying community is huge. I mean, it's thousands and thousands. It's overwhelming. There's a whole new section of Washington. The law firms are huge. I mean, it's a different place than it was 30 years ago. It's many more people, much more complicated. The right to lobby is protected by the First Amendment. There's a right to petition your government for redress of grievances in our Constitution. So it's part of it. But I think it's now recognized the tax code is incredibly complicated because of all the special provisions. It was revised in 86 under President Reagan and was vastly simplified. Well, you know, that's 25, 26 years ago. It's complicated again. It's different. I mean, it's more partisan. There's a multifold increase in lobbying and lobbyists and special interests. And I don't know what you do about it, but it's a different place. In retrospect, having been there 30 years, it was sort of cozy in 83, but I didn't see it that way coming from Santa Fe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.